Welcome to this week's episode of the Mixtape with Scott. I am the host, Scott Cunningham, professor of economics at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. I had to take a couple of weeks hiatus inadvertently. Ended up just kind of painting myself into a corner. Couldn't get a lot of work done, and I'm trying to get it back on track. This week's interview is with a colleague of mine, Peter Klein. He's the W.W. Carruth Endowed Chair at Baylor University. He's not in the economics department, though. He's in the entrepreneurship department. And I wanted to have him on the show for a couple of reasons. One, Peter's actually kind of part of my own story. When I was picking schools, to apply to school, only applied to Emory and the University of Georgia. And they were all kind of because I could see these faculty members and they were working on things I was really passionate about. And like a lot of people, I was really passionate about new institutional economics. That was work by Ronald Coase, Doug North, and Oliver Williamson. And Peter had written this kind of a explainer article for an encyclopedia on new institutional economics. And I went over that article with a highlighter and a pen and paper, like it was the Bible. And I just found it so fascinating. But unfortunately, Peter left right when I got there. He ended up going to Mizzou. And so I never got a chance to study with him. And I know if he had stayed, given the chemistry I had with Peter, he's just such a friendly, extremely funny man, very, very thought-provoking. Every conversation is just very deep and fun, that I would have loved to have, taken courses from him. But I also wanted to have him on the show, probably because, as some of you know, I sort of find these hooks. These kind of narrative hooks. I mean, the concept of the show is to interview living economists and listen to their stories. And the idea being that, we navigate our lives through stories. And you've heard me say that a lot. But it's also, I've got this second layer where, I don't just randomly pick people. I have my own personal interests. I like to think, though, I have a fairly general interest, but I do have my own interests. And I kind of want to, like, flesh them out with the guests. And one of the interests is the econometricians. Another is the natural experiment, causal inference movement paradigm that moved through and won a couple of Nobel Prizes. Gary Becker's students, economists that go into the tech industry. Those have all been like themes, and I continue to flesh those things out. But one of them too is the Austrian economists. I'm very interested in the Austrian economists, which is sort of one pole of the profession and or one of the poles of the history of the of economics. And then this other pole is the I guess it's oftentimes called the heterodox tradition. And one day I hope to kind of explore all that too. And so Peter kind of he'll share even he is a very eclectic kind of intellectual history. He went to the University of California, Berkeley, which he's going to tell you about, where he studied with famed Nobel laureate at the time, not a Nobel laureate, but became a Nobel laureate, Oliver Williamson, sort of working on areas of theory of the firm that and theories of organization that have to do with transaction cost economics, kind of Coasean ideas. But he's very much kind of, as a young man had come into economics through that door, that escalator, that a lot of people come in through reading Austrian books. And that's one of the strengths of the Austrians is they wrote books that were readable by non-economists. And they that's how he got in. And I wanted to talk to him. And I'm going to interview a few more Austrians this season just to kind of continue to sort of flesh that out of the more senior people in the profession. But Peter is his own man, is his own kind of intellectual. He's been on his own intellectual journey. He's come back into my life as a not a colleague in the econ department, like I said, but he's in our entrepreneurship department. So I'm gonna turn it over to my me. I'm gonna and have myself start talking to Peter Klein, professor at Baylor University. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you enjoy this, send it to somebody. All right, see you in 2 seconds later. Well, it's a pleasure to have on the show a colleague of mine and someone that I've known for quite a long time, Dr. Peter Klein. Peter, thanks so much for being on the show.
Hey Scott, thanks for having me. I've been a fan of your show for a while, and it's a pleasure to be a guest.
Well, can you, for the sake of the listener, tell us your name, full title, and the name of the firm that pays your salary?
Sure. I'm Peter Klein. I'm on the faculty at Baylor University, like Scott, and I'm the W.W. Carruth Chair of Entrepreneurship and currently serving as Chair of the Chair of the Entrepreneurship Department. I'm having a bad day. Chair of the Entrepreneurship Department at Baylor. So at the business school at Baylor, we have all the usual departments like most business schools have. Many have econ, of course, all have management, marketing, finance, accounting, information systems, etc. But we also have entrepreneurship as a department. The reason I'm flubbing my lines here is because I got my PhD in economics, and so I identify my sort of core discipline as economics. But I'm a professor of entrepreneurship at Baylor.
Yeah, but what's the deal? If I poke you and you bleed, are you going to bleed economist blood or are you going to
Yeah.
bleed entrepreneurial blood?
It's an interesting question. I suppose the easy answer would be to say that it's not an apples to apples kind of comparison because economics is sort of a core academic discipline like psychology or sociology or political science or whatever. And entrepreneurship, like management or marketing or finance, is more of an applied professional field. So, if you think of entrepreneurship as a domain, then entrepreneurship research draws on economics, actually, probably more on economics than anything else. But there's a lot of entrepreneurship research that that draws primarily on psychology or sociology or some other discipline. I mean, I think maybe some of our friends in, philosophy or mathematics or biology might question whether economics is really a core discipline, whether, they might quibble about the social status of the social sciences per se. But I guess the point is, I don't really see a contradiction here because I think one can use economics tools as well as tools from other disciplines to study the phenomena of entrepreneurship, just like you could study the phenomena of, financial markets or whatever from a variety of disciplinary perspectives.
So you don't really self-identify, kind of like it's your identity. You don't really self-identify and say, I am an economist. That's never been kind of your personality. I'm wondering now if I'm different.
It's a good question, Scott. The way I think of it is, it's a little bit like the question of, what is an academic field anyway? And there's kind of, there's like an intellectual, inward-looking definition of a field or a person in a field based on, what techniques they use and what methods of inquiry they think are appropriate and what theories and constructs they rely on, etc. But there's also kind of a institutional sociological definition. I think in the history of science literature, they call it communities of practice. So that would be like, what conferences do you go to? Which people do you hang out with? What journals do you typically send your stuff to? So, I for the early part of my career, I went primarily to, the American Economic Association and maybe the Southern Economic Association and some other economics conferences. I still go to those from time to time, but I primarily go to conferences that are more in sort of management and entrepreneurship. I primarily submit my articles to journals in that area. So if you ask, what do I identify as? Well, the people I hang out with mostly would consider themselves entrepreneurship professors or management professors more than economists. But if you say, well, what am I in terms of how do I think about formulating a problem? I'm probably more like an economist than anything else.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That sociological community that you belong to reinforcing your personal identity as a particular kind of scientist. I hadn't really connect. I guess I took it for granted that I was an economist first and then go into those places, but that's really kind of interesting. Well, let's start with an icebreaker and get started. So, what's a vacation that you went on as a younger person? Doesn't have to be a kid, but maybe, in the past, that to this day, maybe it's not your favorite vacation, but you've noticed that you've thought about it since you went.
Oh wow, boy, that is a great question. Hard to think of a standalone vacation. So I grew up near the Smoky Mountains in eastern Tennessee, and so I spent a lot of my vacation time in the mountains, either camping or hiking, or basically, like at a cabin, hanging out in the woods and doing outdoorsy kind of stuff. So that certainly had a big influence on me. Although also I had some relatives in South Florida. And so we used to go to the Miami, Fort Lauderdale area, 70s, 80s, when it was really starting to become, built up into this giant megalopolis, that it is now. But that was so, it was very socially and culturally different because, the joke about South Florida is that, it's like closer culturally to New York than it is to anything geographically close to South Florida. That was kind of a different experience. But also something that a lot of people don't know about me, and this is not exactly an answer to your question, but my mother's from the UK. She's from Scotland, and she grew up in a tiny little village not too far from Edinburgh, Scotland. And we used to go there almost maybe every other summer when I was a kid. So I'd spend my summers, part of my summers in Scotland, and that was so different, such a different world, especially in the pre-internet era. That that landscape and those people and that culture sort of tugs at my heartstrings, though I never been able to master a proper Scottish dialect.
That's hard. I went to Stirling last summer and the taxi driver drove me back to the airport and we'd be talking and then like just suddenly, I had no idea what he was saying.
I remember as a kid, I can't remember where we were, some museum or something, and I got separated from my parents and apparently was in a place where I wasn't supposed to be. And the security guard comes out and starts yelling at me and questioning me. And I literally could not understand. Some of it might have been fear, but his accent, his Scottish brogue was so strong. And of course, he didn't believe me that I didn't understand him. He thought I was scamming to try to get out of being in trouble, which only made it worse. But Scott, I'm glad you went to Stirling, but really the true test of your Scottish ancestry is, after you watch the movie Braveheart,
You have
you pick
to.
up a mace or a sword and go kill some English people. If not, then you're not a true Scotsman.
I basically played the type the whole time with the taxi driver. I just asked him about Braveheart the whole time. And you could tell he was like,
Easy way to get the conversation
he's
going.
only the 1,000th American that's done that to him.
And like every Hollywood movie, 100% accurate in every detail.
I was like, I don't want to know the problems with it. I want you just to validate that it's the best movie ever. Well, so you grew up in East Tennessee. Where in East Tennessee? I went to college at UT Knoxville.
Yeah, that's where I grew up, is in Knoxville.
Oh, wow. Oh, what'd your mom and dad do for a living?
Yeah, my dad was a history professor at UT Knoxville.
Oh,
My
no
mom was an
way.
attorney. So we might have passed each other on the street at some point and not even known it.
Yeah, totally, totally. Huh. Did you ever think about that that might be where you ended up or not really wanting to?
I mean, I certainly thought about it because lots of people from, my high school went there as the obvious college alternative. I guess, for me, because my dad worked there and because I'd grown up there, I wanted to get a little bit farther, go a little farther afield. I went to UNC Chapel Hill, which is not that far away. The map, but was really a different place where I could kind of be out on my own and find myself.
Well, so what kind of toys and games and stuff did you play when you were a little kid?
Oh boy. It's funny, I was having a conversation with a friend the other day about how social attitudes towards health and safety have changed so much. But I remember we used to have, there's this infamous kind of a lawn dart. They were called jarts that were famously banned by OSHA or whoever is in, I don't know what government agency would be in charge of this. There are these big metal darts with a sharp pointed tip, and you had this thing like a hula hoop, a plastic circle that you would lay it on the ground, and then you would fling these heavy metal darts and try to get them to land nose first in the circle. But of course, I don't know how many, I don't know how many people were seriously injured, from jarts, but it must have been more than a few. But I, like a lot of, nerdy kind of boys, I like, of course, Legos and,
Yeah.
model building and model trains and all that kind of stuff. But I also played sports and rode my bike and did all the things that, parents no longer allow their kids to do.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So when you were little, did you have any, did you ever, do you remember when you were little ever saying, well, this is what I want to be when I grow up? Like, before high school, what
Yeah,
was it?
that's a great question. There's a lot of professions have what would be the technical term? There's a kind of intergenerational heritability on the occupational side. There's probably a technical term for this that labor economists will know that I'm forgetting. But how much more likely are you to become a doctor or a lawyer or a airplane pilot or whatever, conditional on your parents also holding that occupation, whatever you call that. I mean, that coefficient is very high for academics.
Yeah.
Now, is that is it genetic? Is it environmental? I'm sure it's a combination of things. But what I would say is, compared to friends and peers who, who didn't have parents working in higher ed, I was just a lot more comfortable. I knew what it was, or at least I thought I knew what it was. I had some sense of what it meant professionally to be a scholar. So like my dad, he did normal dad things like other parents, but he didn't clock in and clock out. Sometimes he had a study at home filled with books, and back in that day, cigar smoke and pipe smoke. And he spent a lot of time reading and typing on a typewriter. And his friends would come over and hang out. I got to go to a few academic conferences as a kid, tagging along. So just that universe where people engage in reading and writing and arguing and lecturing and teaching, it seemed natural to me. Whereas, who knows? I don't know. Piloting an airplane did not feel natural to me because I'd never seen anybody do it, up close, like maybe I would have if one of my parents had been a, commercial air pilot. So certainly that has some impact on it. The way I would put it is, when I went to college, I certainly didn't have a career plan mapped out, but I thought, I enjoyed college. And of course, I had summer jobs, working in offices and doing manual labor and doing all kinds of stuff. And I thought, well, I'm happy to do those things to make some money, but I don't feel like I really enjoy them all that much, but I kind of do enjoy school. I mean, I like doing the things that you do as a student. And I thought,
Yeah.
okay, well, maybe I'll go to grad school because that just seems like more of doing something that, feels kind of natural and I enjoy doing. It's not like I really ever sat down and mapped out an academic career. In fact, I was pretty naive, surprisingly naive about, like, how did it work? How do you get a job? How do you get tenure? How do you get published and all that? I mean, my dad was in a totally different academic field, and
Right.
he was a bit older than the average. Like, he was in his 40s when I was born. So I mean, his own experience of going to graduate school and getting a job and getting tenure was very different from what I
Yeah.
would experience. So I just kind of jumped in and I thought, oh, I like doing this stuff and I like reading this and reading that, and I'll just keep doing it until I think of something better to do. And something better to do never came along.
Yeah.
Here
Well,
I am.
in high school, what subjects were you gravitating towards? What classes did you really like?
Yeah, I mean, I went to a, a decent large public high school, but it wasn't like an elite magnet school or private school or college prep school. And I had some good classes, and they had all the AP kinds of classes with a lot of smart kids.
Yeah.
I don't think I really had a specialization in anything. Like, there wasn't like an economics program. I think we had some kind of an econ course, but it was basically like, how to balance your
How's your
checkbook.
checkbook?
There wasn't any really real academic content to it.
Yeah.
It really wasn't until I went to college. So in high school, like a lot of people of my generation who gravitated towards kind of what we would now call libertarian or classical liberal kind of ideas, I
Yeah.
started reading Ayn Rand, which was introduced to me by a friend, and I found her novels very interesting and, intellectually stimulating and all that.
You
And
think
she,
you were primed for that kind of philosophical literature? Were you already reading heavy literature or philosophy
Oh
type
gosh,
stuff?
I don't know. I mean, maybe a little bit heavier than the average high school kid, but not. I don't think I was especially attracted to, super deep philosophical intellectual stuff. I
Yeah.
think, like a lot of adolescent boys, I mean, it was the, Ayn Rand's novels, not her nonfiction books, but her novels, they appeal to this sort of, bright kids who feel a little bit socially awkward and, frustrated by some of what they see around him, this kind of heroic individualism, the kind of romanticism, in like the, I don't know, 19th century literary notion of romanticism, heroes doing great things and fighting against all odds to accomplish their goals single-handedly. That has a lot of kind of visceral, even kind of emotional as well as intellectual appeal. But the reason I bring that up is, I read one of her nonfiction books called Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, which actually has some pretty good stuff in it. And there's like in the back, there's like a list of recommended reading. So this is when I was still in high school.
What
And
year is this? What year is it?
this, so I graduated high school in 1984. So this would have been early 80s. And she recommended books like Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, a book by Ludwig von Mises called The Anti-Capitalist Mentality. I mean, these weren't, they're kind of like general interest books that a layperson could read. But I read those and I thought, oh, wow, these are really great.
That was
So when
high school.
that was high school. Yeah. So when I went to college, I said, well, I already think I feel like I know some economics. I mean, I probably really didn't know very much, but I thought I did. And so I took some, I took all kinds of liberal arts classes. As some of your younger listeners may not realize the extent to which college has really changed. I mean, back in my day, and maybe in your day too, Scott, people really didn't have a major at all, or didn't even know what they wanted to major in until, end of the sophomore year, start of the junior year. Now at Baylor, we get kids coming in first semester freshmen, and they're, accounting majors, and they've already done a bunch of accounting in the summer and blah, blah, blah. So I was dabbling in a little bit of everything, and I took some econ courses. And to be honest, the econ courses I took in college were not that great, but I found them super easy. Like I could barely study and get, 100 on the test or whatever. And I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll end up majoring in this. I already feel like I know some econ on the side from my private reading,
You
and
still
that
active
probably
at this
helps me in
time?
these classes too.
Are you at this time still kind of an active consumer of economic books and articles all outside of your classes?
I would say so.
At that
Active
time.
consumer. Yeah, I mean, again, as a college kid, I probably understood a small percentage of what I read, but I started to learn who people, like Mises or Hayek or Schumpeter or Murray Rothbard. I started to read some of works by these people, which I found very exciting, even if I didn't totally understand everything that they were talking about. And probably that's the reason I ended up as majoring in economics. I did like economics, but it wasn't that I loved my college classes so much. I just thought the area of study was interesting and I could do it just fine in college. But I also enjoyed college classes I took in history, psychology, poli-sci. I guess I probably figured at that point that I didn't want to go into like a STEM, what we are now calling STEM discipline. I think I did fine in chemistry and biology, but I think I got kicked out of the chem lab because I violated some safety procedure and causing a minor explosion or something. Yeah, maybe the natural sciences are not for me.
Well, did you have a community of other friends or like go to conferences or something where you were getting to talk to people that were sort of, you could talk to about this
Yeah.
more Austrian economists or the classical
Not,
liberal?
yeah, not really in college. I mean, I must have known one or two folks who had sort of similar interests, but it was a pretty solitary endeavor back in those days. Again, this is pre-internet, right? So there's, you could, I remember there were some, there were newsletters, magazines that you could subscribe to, and they would come once a month. You'd rush out to the mailbox and you'd grab it and you'd devour the contents of this thing. Like an hour, and then you got to wait another 30 days, to get the next one. So there really wasn't a physical community so much, at least not one that I that I was aware of. A joke I like to tell is, somehow I would hear about some book like, like Human Action, the great treatise by von Mises that is very difficult to read for a beginner. And I would rush off to the library. And, so this would have been late 80s, mid to late 80s. I, get that book from the stacks. And I got to check it out. And back in those days, as you remember, there was a little, I don't know, we probably didn't have anything digitized back then, but there was a little slip of paper, a little card in the back of the book where you would, they would stamp the due date. And so then they would stick that card back in there. So you could see the history of all the times that book had been checked out. And I get these books and it's like, this book hasn't been checked out since, 1954 or something. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm the only person in the world who has any interest in this stuff. But, you felt like you were connected to history
Yeah.
somehow, but like you were totally isolated in the present. So what happened to me, I'm kind of getting ahead of the story a little bit, but in grad school, that was when I first became aware of organizations and institutions that existed that were interested in, like, the Austrian School of Economics or libertarian theories and ideas. That's why I first started going to conferences and I first met other people who had these shared interests. And that was kind of an eye opener. That was kind of a revelation to me because, before that, people like me probably thought, oh, I must be the only person on the whole planet
Right,
who's sort
right.
of interested in this stuff. And again, not to get into the cliche that we always, old people like us always talk about, well, nowadays with social media, blah, blah, blah. But it really is, there are these online communities
Yeah.
where, not to discount the kind of social pathologies that online, the virtual can cause. I've been reading some stuff about Jonathan Haidt's new book, which
Yeah.
is getting a lot of attention, pro and con, on social media and depression among teenagers and so forth. But the positive is that, no matter what weird, obscure interest you have, or you think it's weird and obscure because nobody in your immediate face-to-face friend group is into it,
Yep.
with a few clicks, you can find, a subreddit or, a bunch of websites or, an Instagram account, whatever, with tons of people who are really into that thing. But
Yep.
that really wasn't. We didn't have that experience back in the old days.
Yeah.
When I was a grad student, I had a scholarship from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and I remember finding out that that institute existed from, from a flyer that was on a bulletin board and sending off a letter. I was like shocked that there existed an institute,
Yeah.
named after this guy, and I thought I was the only person who even knew who he was, on the planet, still alive.
Right.
And so when I went and met other people who were into the same stuff, it's like, oh, okay, now if I'm found, I found my tribe.
Right.
But even back then, the tribes didn't interact as frequently because you might see them once a year, or a couple times a year. You'd exchange mail or, phone calls. But again, it wasn't until I was already an assistant professor, I guess, when the commercial internet, became a thing.
Yeah, right. It's got to be that those functions of old conferences, probably that the current conferences are not necessarily building community. Well, I mean, there is, I definitely have felt like some conferences did since that I had my community there, but it seems still like the idea that I found my people is. I bet you that's more, is that more historically what you think those old conferences were like?
That's it's a great question. I don't know if anybody in, like, sociology or cultural anthropology is doing research on this. It's a fascinating research question. Like, what is the community building function of something like an academic conference
Yeah.
or like a physical, meetup today compared to what it was in the past? Because now it's got to be, a complement to other kinds of online
Yeah.
community building. It's not a substitute.
Right.
And, of course, we all know there are certain things that you accomplish from face-to-face interaction,
Yeah.
exchanges of tacit knowledge, and, it's a different kind of community building.
Yeah.
But it's like it's based on a foundation that you already, maybe you kind of feel like you know the person because
Yeah.
you interacted with them on Facebook or Twitter or something.
Yeah.
When you see them in person, you got to dinner together, or you're in a session at a meeting together. That's completely a different form of interaction, but it's like you have this base already. Whereas maybe in the past, when you might have read somebody's article or read their book, but it's much more infrequent. Scott, I'm reminded of the some of your listeners may have heard of one of the most famous organizations like this of people with kind of a free market orientation was the Mont Pelerin Society, which was the first kind of free market intellectual organization. It was founded by the initial meeting was organized by F.A. Hayek in 1947 in at a retreat somewhere in Switzerland. A place called Mont Pelerin is how they got the name. But from what I understand, so this was the immediate post-war period, and from the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, we saw the rise of communism, the rise of fascism. The few intellectuals who identified as, I guess, what we would now call classical liberals, they would have just called themselves liberals. They were a really small, entrenched minority. Most of them were professors at some, or journalists or something at some place where they were the only person within a, 1,000 kilometer, radius. And I think when they all met at this meeting, there's only like 50 or 60 people. Again, it was like a revelation to all of them, the fact that they could feel like they were part of a movement.
Totally.
So I guess maybe that's what it comes, maybe that's another way to think about it is, we all like to be part of something larger than ourselves, and being part of what you think of as an intellectual movement, or maybe it's an activist movement or something, that's very important for us building our identities. And I think doing it in the flesh is different from doing it online, but I'm not an expert in exactly what that means.
I mean, finding those people in the first place, it's, when they're when there's a lot of search frictions, I mean, anything that can just sort of pop up and be like that society. If word gets out, it can just create so much coordination that's difficult to do otherwise, Well, so you go to Chapel Hill, you decide at some point, you're reading like Rothbard and you're reading von Mises, and you decide, I want to go to graduate school, right? You want to be a professor. So I remember, you sort of advising someone, I thought it was you, where you were saying, the most important thing is apply broadly and then go to the best school that you get into, or something. I felt like I heard you one time say, does that sound like something you would have said?
Well, I would put it this way. First of all, there's no one path that's perfect for everybody. But what I tell my students, people applying to grad school, or people for that matter applying for jobs out of grad school, you need to be well informed about the trade-offs, right? So one strategy for grad school is, you want to study this specific thing with this specific person. I want to be the causal inference guy, and my dream is to study with Scott Cunningham. And wherever Scott Cunningham is, that's where I'm going because I want to study that specific thing. That's perfectly legit. That has a lot of advantages, because you're going to the place where you're gonna, or maybe there's a community of people who do that thing. But there are risks, right? The risks, like maybe you go there and, Scott Cunningham leaves. He gets a job at some other school. Or, it turns out Scott Cunningham's a jerk and, you don't get along with him and he treats the students badly and now you're kind of stuck. I think this is more of a problem, by the way, in STEM, where they have the lab model where a specific faculty member is funding you. One of the things I like about, fields like economics, entrepreneurship, is our grad students are funded by the department. You're not tied. Maybe you went there because you especially like this one professor, but you're not tied to that professor. You're not dependent on that professor for your well-being, for your livelihood. So another model is, apply to a lot of different schools and go to the best place that you get into, or maybe the best place you get into with full funding or something like that. Again, as you well know, there are no perfect solutions, only trade-offs. Right. So the advantage of that model is you're not tied to one person. You have a variety of people to work with. And if you're going to the best school that you can get into, then you likely have the best odds on the job market. Right. Because as we know, there's a heck of a lot of pedigree and inbreeding and all kinds of, pathologies in academia, right, where people look at letterhead rather than intrinsic quality, and maybe that's justified. That can be a subject for another day. But because that is, it is that way, it's easier to get a job with a PhD from MIT than it is with a PhD from Baylor or wherever. Again, it's if you want to make a ceteris paribus comparison, I also say it depends on the individual, right? So, like, imagine somebody who could get into MIT and could get a PhD at MIT, but would be miserable. And maybe you wouldn't enjoy it. There's nobody there you can relate to. And maybe your dissertation would actually be worse than it otherwise would be if you had gone someplace where you fit better. So, it's hard to say what's best for each individual. There's an individual fixed effect here that's hard to tease out, when you look more broadly. So I try to give advice to students, lay out all the options. Here are the pros and cons of different models. You have to figure out what's best for you. And you typically only get one shot. You don't we don't really have the transfer portal. I mean, I guess technically we do, but it's like, have you ever been asked, Scott? I am asked sometimes, are you glad you made the choices you did? Scott, are you glad you went to Georgia for your PhD? Well, it's like when I get asked that question, well, I can kind of speculate, but I don't know. I have one observation. I have N equals one. I don't know how I would have done if I'd done something else. I don't really have a counterfactual.
Totally.
Probably what you're getting around to is I personally chose the strategy of just going to the best, highest ranked school that I could get into because I figured it would give me more job market opportunities. I did. I won't mention the names, but I did. Well, I guess I will mention the names. There were some prominent, Austrian economists, or even today prominent Austrian economists, like Israel Kirzner, who was at that time a professor at NYU. I was also interested in kind of history of economic thought, and probably the best university at that time for studying history of economic thought was Duke University. I applied to both Duke and NYU. I got admitted to both Duke and NYU. I interviewed and met the folks, and I mean, this is probably a lot of inappropriate arrogance on my part, but I remember I met Israel Kirzner. I went up to NYU and interviewed, looked around, and I met some of the other faculty, and I thought, gosh, this place is great, but I don't want to get my PhD here. I would rather be a professor here. And to be a professor here, I probably can't get my PhD at NYU. Another guy who I'm still friends with, Mario Rizzo, was a colleague of Kirzner's and also an Austrian school economist. And I don't know if I said this to him or if I was just thinking it, but he got his PhD at Chicago. And then he was running the Austrian program at NYU. And I'm thinking, well, if I want to be somebody like you, I need to get a PhD at someplace like Chicago so then I can come to NYU. Again, the hubris of youth is always kind of fun, but that was kind of my mentality, and I thought I need to go someplace a little bit better than the places I want to end up. So the best place that I got into was Berkeley, and so Berkeley was where I decided to go. I also have my older brother was living in the San Francisco area at that time, so I had some family in that area, and of course it was California, and it sounded really cool and fun. And the Mises Institute also had an office in the San Francisco area in a little office park down near the San Francisco airport in a town called Burlingame. So I knew if I went there, I would have a family member nearby, and I knew I would have some other kind of intellectual comrades in the area, even if they weren't in the PhD program with me. And it was also a very large PhD program, as it still is today. So I figured, I would get along with at least some of the folks there, and I certainly did.
Well, did you go there kind of knowing that Oliver Williamson was there, or is it like a complete blank slate? You just know it's a fantastic program.
No, I didn't know who Oliver Williamson was, the guy who ended up being my advisor. He actually came to Berkeley right around the same time I did, from Yale, and I didn't know his work at all, but Berkeley had this thing where, because it was a large department, gosh, it must have been 25, 30, 40, maybe more, 40, 45 faculty, big PhD program. So you didn't really know who everybody was. And they had these little, for first year PhD students, they had little brown bags where, like, every week professors representing a different field of study would come and introduce themselves and introduce their field. So, the labor economists would come 1 week and they would talk about the labor econ field, and then the macroeconomists would come and the international economists would come, whatever. And one of those was for institutional economics.
Oh.
And Williamson, because Berkeley was offering a field sequence in institutional economics,
New
and Williamson,
institutional or the traditional
I mean, they just,
institutional?
well, I mean, it was what we would now call new institutional, but I think at that time they just called it institutional.
It had a
I think it was
brand
called.
already at that point. It was kind of a school.
So that's a good question. I mean, Williamson's PhD course for second year students was just called Economics of Institutions.
Oh, it wasn't IO?
So, I mean, no, there was also an IO sequence,
He didn't.
which I
He had a
took.
separate
Yeah, he had
PhD sequence.
that's right. He had a course, and Berkeley had a field in the economics of institutions
Oh.
separate from the industrial organization sequence.
Wow.
So, yeah, I guess the IO guys must have come and presented one day, and that would have been Joseph Farrell, Michael Katz. Who else would have done IO at that time? Maybe Benjamin Hermelin, who's now the provost at Berkeley, Richard Gilbert, but then Williamson also did a separate. So Williamson's presentation was not IO; it was Economics of Institutions. There's an interesting story, by the way. I don't know if we have time to get into it, which some of which I've only recently learned about. The reason, the short answer is the reason that Williamson came to Berkeley was because he was trying to establish, a program, an initiative, an institute, a center. I don't know what you would call it. It wasn't the physical manifestation wasn't as important as like the intellectual community
Yeah.
to promote what he called the economics of organization or the economics of institutions. Nowadays, NBER has an organizational economics working group, and that's a subject category, but at that time there was no such thing. And Williamson had tried in both at Penn and at Yale to establish like an organizational economics thing without success. And he was frustrated by a lot of pushback that he got at Yale. So at what apparently what happened at Yale is that people in sort of organizational sociology, what in business,
Oh.
in the management field, what we now call organizational behavior. The
Yeah.
organization of behavior field, which is mostly sociologists and psychologists, they would not give up control of the study of organizations to the economists.
Right.
Or Williamson is a very interdisciplinary kind of a guy, but he wanted economics to be part of that conversation, and he was buffed. And so he came to Berkeley with the promise that he would be able to create some kind of, again, institution or organization to study institutions and organizations.
Wow.
It was partly funded by the econ department, partly by the business school, the law
Did he
school.
bring some faculty with him? Did he bring some faculty?
So I think I think he must have come with the promise of getting to do some faculty hiring,
Ah,
but he only came as himself.
got it.
He had a appoint. He had a mul I think he had a triple appointment in the business school, econ department, and law. But anyway,
Wow.
to get back to your question, so remember, I had this kind of idiosyncratic background.
Yeah.
I was good enough at quantitative methods to do well in all my undergrad courses, and in math and stat as well as econ, even though it probably wasn't as technical in the mid 80s as it is in 2024. But and so so as a first year student at Berkeley, my classes are all math, econ, and micro. I think we must have been taking micro, macro, and econometrics. I did a summer. There was like a boot camp in the summer. And I was doing okay in all those classes. I was passing them. I was making satisfactory grades in all those classes, but I wasn't really enjoying them all that much. I mean, it was a 100% technique. There's almost nothing about ideas and the big picture stuff or
Yeah.
policy, that stuff. And I
Right.
mean, I guess I kind of, that was sort of what I expected. So my mentality was, I'm going to buckle up, get through all this, and then as a more advanced student, then I can pursue stuff I'm really more interested in, which I guess a lot of students do. But when I went to this little brown bag thing, Williamson handed out his syllabus, the syllabus for his course, which would be taken in the second year. So this, it was like a preview of what I would get in the next year if I took Williamson's course. And I still have a copy of that syllabus. I can share it with you for you to post if you want. But I mean, it was mind-blowing for me because, this was a Berkeley professor at the top of his game. He would go on to win a Nobel Prize, as your listeners, I'm sure, know. The syllabus was like, it was this really idiosyncratic mix of stuff. So there were all kinds of classic economics papers, not just by the standard authors that we were reading at the time, but also, of course, by Coase, Armin Alshin, Harold Demsetz, Stephen Chung,
Is
probably Paul
Ostrom on there?
Purcell.
Did you ever notice
Ostrom was
Ostrom?
probably on there too. I'll have to go back and, but also,
Because he
Williamson.
seems like he knows her that day that they both win. I noticed that I don't know. I got the sense that they knew each other a little bit. Is that
Oh
accurate?
yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that some of Ostrom's stuff was in our curriculum. It wasn't as large a part as maybe some other. He was more it was more Coase was more of a guy north. But we read, Kenneth Arrow's paper on information economics, which but also Williamson was trained at Carnegie Mellon back in the 60s, and so we had stuff by Syert and March, who wrote a famous book on what, sort of what would become behavioral economics. And there was like Oscar Morgenstern, early kind of theoretic stuff,
Oh,
but
so
there
he
was some
comes from
political
there.
science, there was some sociology, there was all kinds of stuff. And I thought, okay, man, this is going to be interesting. And he had Hayek on there. And I thought, these are articles that I would just want to read for fun, even if I didn't have to. So I want to take this course. And so the way they made it a field actually was you took Williamson's course, then you took a course in agency theory and mechanism design with Ben Hermelin, which at that point was a little bit more avant-garde. Now it's more, there's more of that in mainstream micro and a PhD sequence. But back then, this would have been 80, 88, 89, 90, around that time. A lot of this stuff was quite a bit newer. So we took Williamson's course, which had some technical parts, but wasn't really a heavily mathematical course. And then we took this course in mechanism design that was very mathematical, and somehow they bundled that into a field of study. So I did that. I also did the IO field and, passed all the exams, whatever, and then decided to write my dissertation with Williamson because I thought he was the most interesting guy on the faculty.
Well, how did y'all gel? What was he like as an advisor?
I mean, he was great, although he was, he was an older gentleman and he was kind of old school. I mean, not that he was friendly, but he wasn't touchy-feely. He wasn't gushy. And it was a more formal kind of relationship than I think a lot of students are used to today. So it wasn't like, weekly bull sessions in his office. It was a little bit more structured, but he gave prompt, feedback and very useful feedback on, dissertation chapters and all that. He didn't give great feedback on the job market, because I mean, it's so interesting if you read Williamson's biography, his autobiography, and you read more about kind of the milieu in which he came into the in which he started his career. Obviously, he's a super smart guy, but he was friends with everybody. All the elite scholars of that time, and he got his stuff published in all the elite journals, and never seemed to have any career problems. And I think he just sort of assumed that that would happen for all of us too, that you just do good work and everything will sort of fall into place, which of course not how it happened. But I can tell you a joke along those lines. There was another student, a classmate of mine, but he was actually not in the econ department. I think he was in marketing, but he had Williamson as his advisor. And there was this deal where he was almost finished with his dissertation, but not quite. He went on the job market and he got a tenure track job offer at a good university, with like an August 1 start date. And but the condition was he had to have defended his dissertation, by August 1st. And he was cutting it close. It was like the summer. and he was getting pretty far along, but not quite. And Williamson wanted more changes, and it was questionable whether he would make the deadline or not. And so he sends Williamson this email. I think so. He sends like what he is hoping is like the final draft, or like the next to final draft. And he sends it to Williamson, you know, with this email, I guess. And he says, "So, you know, here's what I've got. Do you think I can finish by August 1?" And Williamson writes back, how did he put it? He said, "Oh yeah, you could." Oh no. So, I'm sorry. It was Williamson sent him a list of corrections. That was it.
Yeah.
Williamson sends him this lengthy list of revisions. And so the guy writes back and says, "Do you think I can accomplish all these revisions by the deadline? That's the question." And a few days later, you know, the tongue-in-cheek response comes back. Williamson says, "Oh yeah, I think you could do all these revisions by the deadline if you were the smartest person I've ever met. And I know Herbert Simon, I know Ronald Coase, I know Kenneth Arrow." He goes through this list of all like the super geniuses that he knows. And so the punchline is the guy actually did do the revisions. And so we always referred to him after that as the smartest person that Oliver Williamson, you know, ever met.
That's great. That's great. So what'd you do your job? What was your job market paper?
Yeah, so my dissertation was, let me actually get to that in a roundabout way. Even though I had these kind of idiosyncratic interests, I wanted to do a slightly more mainstream dissertation, you know, again, just for kind of career purposes. Not that I was doing stuff that I thought that I fundamentally disagreed with, but I positioned the research in a way that I hoped would seem reasonable to the typical academic economist. And I was planning to go on the econ job market. I could have gone on the business school job market, something like strategic management. In hindsight, that probably would have been a smarter career move, but I didn't know that much about that part of the market. I mean, I never took a single business course as an undergrad. I mean, I didn't know what business academics was. I had no idea. And I didn't know there was a field of like organization studies or business strategy, which was kind of the same stuff I was doing, just it's differently, but I didn't know that existed. Anyway, so my dissertation was kind of a business history dissertation. I was interested in organizations, and so I was studying the emergence of a particular kind of organizational form from like the 1950s to the present at that time, you know, to the 1980s.
What was
Namely,
it?
you had big, and if you look at kind of Western business history, you're going through different phases. You had these large vertically integrated companies that emerged in the late 19th century, like Standard Oil and US Steel, Alcoa, right? They were large manufacturing, or in the case of oil, you know, extraction businesses, refining businesses, but they were highly vertically integrated both backwards and forwards. So, Alcoa was, you know, owning the mines where the aluminum was being mined, and then they owned all the different refining stages, and they were producing finished aluminum and all that. So the big mega companies that we think of for, you know, the robber baron era, they were all highly specialized companies. They were sort of all in one industry. And you had ones like, you know, JP Morgan or whatever, were all in finance as well as these kind of more industrial companies. What began to emerge, so you had these big robber baron companies late 19th century. Then in the 19 teens and 1920s, you began to see the emergence of more diversified companies like General Motors, right, which was all in automobiles, but had these multiple different brands or lines, and they were managed. You know, there's a famous book by Alfred Chandler, a couple of famous books by the historian Alfred D. Chandler Jr., one called Strategy and Structure, published in 1962, I think, and then one called The Visible Hand, published in 1977, which won all the awards, you know, like the equivalent Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction and so forth. You know, The Visible Hand, of course, being a play on Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, Chandler argued that these large multi-business companies were, substituting what he called the visible hand of management in allocating resources across their different subsidiaries than the invisible hand of the market. So in the 50s and 60s, you saw the rise of conglomerate companies that were like wildly diversified, way beyond something like GM. You had companies that, they had a bunch of different manufacturing concerns, and they had service businesses, and they were in, they owned a bank, and they owned an agricultural, facility, as well as, heavy industry and so forth. They were like, there was no kind of business focus at all. And I was really interested in these companies, not only from a purely kind of economic point of view, like, is there any economic rationale for them? And there were critics at the time who said, look, this is just kind of like, it's a way to get around like antitrust concerns. So if you tried to become, a billion-dollar company in that day by dominating one industry, you would fall afoul of the antitrust, competition policy authorities. So one theory was, well, these big companies were just gobbling up all kinds of unrelated businesses so they could grow rapidly without dominating any one industry sector, and therefore getting around antitrust concerns. And so what I was interested in, and other people had written about this, Williamson had written a little bit about it, but not studied it in a huge amount of detail, was, again, is there some economic efficiency gain from doing this rather than just empire building or, regulatory concerns? And so I did an empirical study of a set of large American conglomerate companies. Something that was also was there was also an interesting political economy aspect to this, because these big conglomerates, they were very they were outside, to go back to our earlier conversation about community, they were not part of the old boys club. The big industrial concerns were all headquartered in the East, in the Northeast, or Pennsylvania in the case of steel, and they were in all the gentlemen's clubs, and they were part of all the elite, social networks of the time. The conglomerate companies were headquartered in places like California and Texas, which were new states at that time. Their founders did not go to Harvard or Yale. Their founders were not in the such and such club, in Boston. They were not part of the old boy or old gal network. I guess it was mostly boys at that time, right? And so they were kind of political outsiders. And there was one sort of theory that held that the dominant incumbents at the time, who were threatened by these conglomerate firms, were trying to use the political establishment to sort of shut them down, because they, they weren't part of the, they didn't lobby, they didn't have trade associations, they weren't friendly with the political authorities the way the old school companies were. So I did this empirical study, using techniques that, in 2024 would be considered, would not be, the results would not be dispositive, let's put it that way, but techniques that were reasonable sort of at the time. You and I have actually talked about this a little bit in another context, but I did some kind of, what's now almost like a diff and diff, kind of like a proto, it's like a pro, a proto diff and diff kind of a model, where what I did essentially was I took this sample of diversified companies, and then I constructed artificial kind of like pseudo companies as matched pairs, where, so, if the diversified company has subsidiaries in industries A, B, and C, 20% of its assets are in industry A, and 30% are in B, and 50% are in C, I would take, like, randomly select a standalone company in industry A with some other matching criteria applied as well, a standalone company in industry B, standalone company in industry C, then construct a weighted average of their performance outcomes using the weights corresponding with the relative size of that business in the diversified firm's portfolio, and then
That's
basically
awesome.
just compare the two. And I also looked at some regulatory and sort of industry shocks to see if the difference between the sample firms and their pseudo conglomerates was different before or after these shocks. It's a, again a li it's a little bit like synthetic control,
Yeah, it
we
sounds
now
it.
call synthetic control, but it, algorithmically, it's not exactly the same, and there was more manual construction than the way we would do it today. But kind of, intuitively, it's kind of like synthetic control and diff and diff. And I got some good stuff out of it. I got one pu paper published in the Rand Journal of Economics, which is, top field journal in IO out of that. I got another book chapter that just barely missed out on being in management science, a special issue of management science. And it, so I wrote a few other papers on the general topic of kind of diversification and organizational structure. So to go back to something you said before, I mean, I was inspired by ideas of people like Coase and Williamson and other org theorists at that time, but also some of my Austrian, intuition was playing a role in that too, because I was thinking about, tacit knowledge that Hayek emphasized, or what Mises had written about the problem of socialist economic calculation. And now when you have, one large entity that, that lacks the information that is contained in market prices, it's hard to know how to allocate resources efficiently. And so large diversified firms and large vertically integrated firms have this kind of problem too, right? That you're allocating resources by managerial fiat, as Coase called it, without reference to the price mechanism. Now, if there's an external market for that same service or commodity, you can use that as a reference. In accounting, they call them transfer prices. Your A division is selling to your B division. Selling, it's not a real market transaction. It's an accounting entry, but you have to have some way. You have to have like a price or a pretend price, so you can calculate like the relative profitability of each activity to decide whether you want to keep it, spin it off, and so forth. So you do need some access to something that looks like prices. And to me, this seemed very similar to what Mises had talked about when he thought that socialist economies could not allocate resources effectively because they lacked a price mechanism. So I was trying to draw some analogies there. I actually wrote a paper called, the title was Socialism and the Theory of the Firm, that I presented at Williamson's seminar as grad student. And I got some good comments from Williamson, even though he didn't like it as much as I expected he would. But it's, there was a very famous Sovietologist named Alek Nov, Nove, who was like a visiting scholar at that time. I didn't know, I didn't know him, but he happened to be on campus, and he must have seen the title of the seminar, and he went and sat in the back of the room, and he didn't say much. But then he sent me this long, like 3-page single-spaced letter with a lot of incredibly useful suggestions and comments. And I found out later he was like one of the world's leading experts on the Soviet economy. And just like, that's, the question of where you should go to grad school, where you should try to work. I mean, one advantage of being at these higher ranked places is you're more likely serendipitously to bump into somebody, that you otherwise wouldn't meet. And Williamson ran a seminar series with guest speakers that was phenomenal. I mean, a ton of Nobel laureates, future Nobel laureates came through there. Herbert Simon gave a talk. Arrow gave a talk. I'd have to dig up the list, but lots of super interesting and famous people. Gordon Tullock, I remember, came in one time. Once I was getting on the elevator, and Williamson got on the elevator with another older gentleman, who I didn't know, and Williamson introduced me to him, and I said hello, and I made some probably completely inappropriate smart alecky kind of joke. I think Williamson said, this person is this very eminent sociologist, and I probably,
Sorry, my bad. I accidentally was getting Alexa was Alexa, stop. Okay, keep going.
so this, I'm introduced to this prominent sociologist. And I think I made some smart alecky remark about sociologists or something. And then later I found out it was James March, who was probably at that time the most famous, one of the most famous sociologists of all time. He wrote that March and Simon book, that sort of foundation for behavioral economics, behavioral social science. And being a snot-nosed kid, I didn't know who this person was. I thought I could be clever. But anyway, interacting with people that are smarter than you, and from whom you can learn something, is, that's important for all of us, for our intellectual growth. That is an advantage of going to, the best place you can go to. But there are drawbacks too. I mean, like social isolation, and maybe you don't do as well, and maybe, it's just more stressful. I mean, there are all kinds of pros and cons. So there's no one size fits all solution.
Well, even getting mentorship, I mean, I imagine You can, if you're too far away in some intellectual distance, graph from your mentors, you might not even necessarily be able to benefit from their
I think
guidance
that's
or,
true. And I think it depends on your personality type too. Some people are very self-motivated. Some people need more reassurance and feedback, and so that would play into the decision too.
Well, to transition a little bit, I mean, this book that you've written with Nikolai Foss, Why Managers Matter, The Perils of the Bossless Company. I want to talk a little bit about this before we go. A lot of what you said, I feel like I hear echoes of it, at least in a little bit of this, the idea that, maybe the manager is a bit of a visible hand. And so I was just kind of curious, what is this book about and where did it come from?
Yeah, so I mean, I've written some, papers over the years on different aspects of, organizational design, like how should a company structure the hierarchy, how much, to what extent should you delegate decision authority or decentralize, to lower levels of the organization. We work in a institution, the university, which really is extremely decentralized. In the sense that, professors have a lot of autonomy in the classroom, in their research, and so forth. But you can imagine, factory work or whatever, where you have line workers, and we're basically the line workers of the university, right? But imagine that you had a very, defined set of responsibilities with very little latitude. Which of those is which is right, which is wrong? I've done some research in that area. But along with my co-author on that book, Nikolai Foss, and we, if I'm completely transparent with you, we wanted to try our hand at writing something on this topic that would be accessible to a general audience, non-specialist audience. So I knew a little bit about book publishing because I'd published a few, Foss and I wrote an academic book in 2002, published by Cambridge University Press, and I'd written book chapters and edited some, books for other academic publishers, and I sort of knew what that was about. But those kind of books, the list price is like, $150 on Amazon, and nobody buys them except academic libraries, and who knows how many people read them. And Nikolai and I thought, could we write, like what you might call a Barnes and Noble book? Kind of book you're at the airport bookstore, you're looking for something to read on the plane, and there it is with all the business books. Could we write something in that genre? And we did, and I think we did a good job. We learned a lot about how that publishing market works, and we can talk about that later if you want. But so the idea was to write something that the typical business person could pick up and read, a manager, an entrepreneur, a student, an aspiring manager. Really, anyone interested in how organizations work could understand it. And so there are a lot of examples, doesn't use a lot of technical jargon. It's, easy to read, which, as you know, Scott, that is a very difficult kind of writing for us, for people like us. It's much harder than writing an academic article. And we had a very good editor, and an editor in for a trade book is not like a journal editor. I mean, they actually edit the prose. They work with you through multiple rounds to make it more readable and to help you organize it and to help you come up with examples, blah, blah, blah. So what the book does is it's a response to, or it's challenging an idea that is very popular in some segments of the startup world, the tech world. And it's this idea that all organizations should be as flexible, as lean, and as flat as possible. So we're addressing this idea that companies should always try to flatten the hierarchy. They should get rid of unnecessary layers of middle management. Everything should be as lean, as flex and flexible as possible. To the extent possible, every employee should have maximum autonomy and freedom to make their own decisions without being constrained by some middle manager. Middle managers get a bad rap. You think of like, a Dilbert cartoon or something, where you've got these productive workers, engineers or professors or whatever, and they're always being, stymied by some associate dean or some assistant vice president for XYZ, the what is it, the pointy-headed boss in Dilbert, who people don't actually contribute anything productively, but they're always sort of getting in the way. If we could
Yeah.
get rid of these people and empower workers, then all organizations would flourish. That's what we call the myth of the bossless company. The myth is the idea that all companies can get better if they, maybe they can't be completely, literally bossless, but they can be as close to that as possible, where
Yeah.
you make everything lean and flat. So what we argue with, I mean, there is a lot of academic research that underlies the ideas in the book. We don't present regression tables or anything, but we do footnote studies that people can refer to. But we summarize some academic studies and give lots of examples and illustrations claiming that that argument is wrong, meaning the argument that it is always better to flatten the hierarchy is an incorrect argument. And Scott, as a distinguished academic yourself, you can immediately see the potential flaw there. I mean, we never state things in that in those kind of absolute terms. In academia, we always state them in sort of contingency language. So what we say in the book is the correct theory is, decentralization, delegation, empowering workers, flattening the hierarchy, making the organization more agile, whatever term you want to use, those things have some benefits. Right. So you can take, as Hayek put it, you can take better, make better use, more effective use of decentralized, dispersed tacit knowledge. You can provide maybe better motivation for employees who are more satisfied and encouraged that they have autonomy and latitude. They can be more innovative in some cases when they're free to, to take advantage of their own skills and exploit their own skills and form their own teams and so forth. But that kind of a model also has a number of serious drawbacks or disadvantages, namely high coordination costs or transaction costs, right? The left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. The different aspects of the project don't fit, they don't coordinate well. And so you end up with a variety of kind of breakdowns from a lack of coordination among the parts. Now, under what circumstances, think of this in comparative, what economists would call comparative statics terms. When are the advantages likely to outweigh the disadvantages? Well, we identify in the book key contingencies, the most important of which is what we call interdependence or interdependency among the different jobs, tasks, subunits, right? If they're mostly independent of each other, then decentralizing, flattening the hierarchy gives you all these great benefits and the costs are not that large. But if you have a lot of interdependence, then decentralization is likely to bring costs that are greater than the benefits because the pieces don't fit. It's like, just to give two quick examples, think about, the Henry Ford's assembly line. Right? I mean, yeah, of course, you want to give the people at each station a little bit of latitude to make adjustments to their machine and some control over their workflow, but it can't be beyond a certain level. That's just going to cause problems because, you need, as the car bodies advance down the line, the opening here has your part has to fit, the thing has to fit in the hole, right? The pieces have to mesh together. It has to be temporally in, synchronized. Otherwise, you get a pile up or you get somebody waiting for the next stage to come. You need tight coordination. A symphony orchestra is another example where you need tight coordination and less autonomy among the different individual participants to make it work. Or think about higher ed. I mean, like I said, we have a lot of autonomy, and which is generally for the good, but there are some coordination problems that people, any students who are listening to this will appreciate these. I always give this example with my own students. I say, have you ever been in a class where the professor says, okay, well, to under, you know, to pass the next exam, you really need to know XYZ, but you already had that in the prereq, so I don't need to cover it. Boom, and they go on to the next thing. And the students are like, we didn't actually get that in the prereq. Or the professor is going on and on and on and on about something, and the students raise their hand. We heard this three other times in three other classes that we took with yours. The reason we have those coordination failures is because we don't share syllabi. Right? You don't just take a course, you take a sequence of courses for a major or a minor, and they're all supposed to fit together. But because at the university we place so much emphasis on instructor autonomy, we tend to do a bad job of making a sequence of courses fit together. That's an example of the discoordination or coordination failure that can arise from too much autonomy. So we
Yeah.
wrote a book to say the guru books that say, here are the five, let you know, here's the secret sauce to making your company more successful. Just do this. The guru books are always wrong
Yeah.
because what works best for your company is always contingent on things specific to your firm, your people, your industry, your technology. And that's what we argue in the book.
Yeah, sure. You can hear the echoes of Coase and Williamson in that kind of thing where, I mean, you're thinking about basic ideas like the transaction costs associated with doing this on the outside changes the organization of the firm.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That I think that's one of the, basic Coasean insight is the optimal size, structure, shape, whatever. It depends on these different characteristics, asset specificity, as Williamson called it, characteristics of your resources, characteristics of your people, characteristics of your trading partners. You got to, the skill to be a good manager is to identify what these contingencies are. I mean, we provide a framework. The manager has can figure out how does this framework apply to my company, my industry, my business, my workers, and figure out how much flattening I want to do. It's probably not zero, but it's not, infinity either.
Well, so with this, work from home, COVID, the development of all this extensive, Zoom, Slack, all of this like telecommunication technologies that have allowed for worker interactions to change. What do you think that's done to the productivity of the manager?
Yeah, I mean, on average, well, it certainly changed the role of the manager in many cases, right? Because you're managing more at a distance, okay? But on the other hand, you do have access to some digital information that maybe you wouldn't otherwise have. Let me answer the question two ways. I mean, first, there's prob so work from home typically is a slightly more decentralized model than work face to face. Not in every case, but in many cases it is. Okay. And probably many firms, the pendulum swung a little bit too far in that direction because everything was shut down, for 2 years. Okay, now we're back in a world where you can work from home sometimes, but you don't have to. So I think a lot of firms are still figuring this out, and there are probably many kinds of businesses that are still a little bit too reliant on work from home. Workers have gotten used to it. Maybe if workers require this as a perk or a work condition, then maybe that's something you need to do to attract the people that you want to attract. But I think a lot of companies are rediscovering benefits of face-to-face interaction. Certainly we have in our profession, right? And so finding that balance, in different businesses and different industries, I think, the market's still trying to work that out. But the second way to answer your question is to generalize it slightly to make it more about technology and digitalization. So I actually have this one paper where we look at, we have some survey evidence from managers about how they view, the access to digital tools in the workplace, right? So the standard argument is because now we have all, we have massive amounts of data. We can track what people are doing. People don't have to be face to face. They can exchange stuff on a website. They can exchange things in email. In fact, that will lead to more delegation and more decentralization of many activities. But a lot of, I mean, here's one example we use in the book is most people talk about flattening the hierarchy. They only think about the benefits in one direction. Right. So there's this famous email from Elon Musk to Tesla employees where he says, I believe in a flatter structure. And he says, anyone at Tesla should be able to talk to anyone else at Tesla, including the CEO, without having to go through a bunch of layers of management. So if you're like a low-level line worker at Tesla and you've got an issue or a problem, in theory, you can go straight to Elon with your complaint or your suggestion without having to go through layers. And that sounds great if you're the kind of person who wants to offer a lot of suggestions. But the flip side of that is that, Elon Musk is also only one phone call or email away from you, right? You may not like the fact that the boss is right there peering over your shoulder. You might prefer a few layers of middle management to be a buffer, right? To protect you from, possible harm that could come from the top. So the survey we did of managers in Europe showed that a lot of them, they said that they were actually micromanaging more after they implemented, digital dashboards and so forth than they were before. Like when they upgraded their ERP systems or whatever, to where now I can control everything that's going on in the organization right here from my desktop. I mean, yeah, in principle, that means my workers can go off and do their thing and they don't have to wait for me to tell them what to do. But it also means I can track them in real time and know exactly what they're doing. The temptation to stick my nose in places where it doesn't belong may be higher than it was where I've got to go to the guy under me, who goes to the gal under him, and so forth until we get down to where the action is. So having those buffering layers can be beneficial as well as potentially harmful, and we shouldn't just jump to the conclusion that we need to squeeze them all out. So digitalization, work from home, and these other innovations, they can allow for better working conditions and more autonomy and more innovation and so forth, but they can also lead to more micromanagement.
Would that surprise you? Does that make a lot of sense now that you think about it? Or were you surprised when you started thinking about that?
We were initially surprised, but I think, when you think about it a little bit more, it does kind of make sense. It's like, okay, I mean, if you have if you have teenagers, you can track their location on your phone. You think, oh, well, they've got a phone now. They can drive, they can go out and do their thing. I don't need to worry. But of course, I can also find out exactly where they are. Okay, who are you with? Why are you there? I notice your car has been parked here for longer than needs to be. What's going on? Which, when you and I were teenagers, our parents didn't, weren't able to do that. So on balance, do teenagers have more freedom today or less freedom? I don't know. It's kind of hard to say.
Well, I kind of want to close with one thing. I've heard somebody say, one of the things that senior people helps with their productivity is kind of being a part of a co-author team that turns out to work really well. And you and Nikolai Foss have become just a really, really close group, a close team of co-authoring. And I was curious, I mean, why is it that you and him sort of have worked so well together, and how long has that been going on?
Yeah, that's a great question.
He's at Copenhagen Business
Yeah,
School.
he's at the Copenhagen Business School in Denmark, which is a top business school, top European business school. Your observation is interesting because sometimes when PhD students or junior scholars ask about, how do I find co-authors? How do I create that kind of a team or a certain kinds of teams? If you look at the CVs of senior people, a lot of times what you find is they've probably written a lot of papers and they probably have a lot of co-authors, but you'll see a lot of one-off or two-off co-authoring relationships. And then you'll see they've written, 12 papers with the same person or set of people. Okay, so that tells you right away there is some experimentation. And we're all opportunistic to some degree. Somebody comes to you and says, hey, I've got this idea in mind. Would you like to work on it with me? And if you think the marginal expected benefits outweigh the marginal expected costs, you're like, yeah, I'll jump on. I'll give that a shot. But then if that co-authoring relationship only occurred once, that probably tells you, the outside observer, that they just didn't mesh. It didn't work for some reason. Then when you see people working together a lot, as you've just observed, okay, so there must be something going on. So what is it? I mean, he and I actually, going back to the earlier comment about community, I had read one or two articles that he had written when I was a very, junior professor. I think he had read a couple of things that I'd written. And then we met at a conference. Actually, the greatest conference I've ever attended was the inaugural meeting of what was then called the International Society for New Institutional Economics. It was at Washington University, St. Louis in 1997. I remember it very well because the speaker lineup was Ronald Coase, Douglas North, Oliver Williamson, Mansur Olson, Harold Demsetz, Paul Joskow. I mean, it was a ton and ton of super fascinating, interesting people. And Nikolai was also at that conference. That's the first time we met face to face. And I think at that point we decided we were going to collaborate on a workshop. Like, he had some funds to organize a workshop in Europe. And I was like, yeah, I want to go to Europe. I want to go to Denmark. And so we decided to organize a small conference on applications of Austrian economics to issues in the theory of the firm. And so we did organize a workshop in Copenhagen, and an edited volume came out of that, which I think is pretty good. And I don't know, we then we started just to discuss other things we wanted to write and work on. And I think he and I have a good complementarity, and also a lot of things in common. I guess, you know, it's like you've seen these studies of diversity in teams, which
Yeah.
show the optimal level of diversity. It's nonlinear, right? If everybody's exactly the same, there's no benefit in collaboration. But if everybody's completely different, you don't speak the same language, you don't get
Yeah.
along. So I think what that's also what you find in many co-authoring teams. Sometimes you have like a theorist and an empirical person, and you know, the division of labor is very obvious in every paper.
Right.
But with Foss and myself, it's not exactly like that. I think we, you know, we have a shared interest, we share interest in the same kinds of topics. We have very similar kind of intellectual backgrounds. We like the same authors. We kind of speak the same language. Of course, we get along very well personally, but we're not identical. I mean, we have some differences of opinion on, you know, a few core issues. I think we have just enough, there's just enough tension that the interactions lead to fruitful and useful outcomes. So it's been a very successful relationship. You know, but I like to work with a variety of different authors as does Nikolai. So.
Well, I've kept you a little bit over the top of the hour. I think I've told you this, and then I'll say more of this in the opening, but when I went to the University of Georgia, there was like a handful of reasons that I wanted to go. And you were one of them. It was a bummer that you were leaving right when I got there, but I've really enjoyed having you come back around the universe correcting itself, and then we're both at Baylor.
Yeah, I was so excited when I found out about this position at Baylor. I don't know if you remember. I think I emailed you and said,
Yeah, I think
"Hey,
about that.
there's a job at Baylor. Well, you know, tell me about this place." Because I was thinking, "Oh, that'd be great to get back." As you said, we just missed each other at Georgia, but this was a chance to get that alignment the way
That's
it always
right.
should be. But
That's right.
I, you know, you're the only person I knew. Well, I mean, I had some other acquaintances. And the people who were recruiting me in entrepreneurship, I knew casually, but the only person I felt like I could say, okay, what's it really like to work there was you. And so you gave me some good advice.
Well, I've been really enjoying having you here. It's really wonderful. Well, I've really loved getting to hear your story and to talk to you and to hear all of your thoughts about your career and economics and entrepreneurship. I really appreciate you being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. I've enjoyed the conversation and happy to chat at any time.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll talk to you later. I'll see you
All
around
right, thanks,
campus.
Scott.